It's Sunday morning. Time for the Great Outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. Hope you enjoy this morning's show. And for those of you who saw the eclipse last week, you will know what I am talking about and what is something that you had to see to believe. I actually was not in Illinois to see the eclipse. I flew into Salt Lake City late in the day last Sunday before the eclipse and drove well into the night to get high into the mountains of Idaho, where the total darkness was going to occur at about 8,000 feet. And I had really did not have, I didn't know what to expect. I'm not an eclipse mania person, but I figured that since I had many friends who were holding parties to watch the eclipse, and the weather forecast in Idaho was for clear skies, and in southern Illinois it appeared as though it might be dicey, Idaho was the better place to go. But what I wasn't prepared for is what actually happens during the totality of the eclipse. And so I'm going to take a moment. For those of you who saw it firsthand, you may relate to some of this. And for those of you who didn't, I'm going to try to give you a sense for what it really felt like, because it's, well, we're going to have a chance here in Illinois again in 7 years. Most of the country is not going to have a chance again in our lifetime. So the beginning of the eclipse, it was about an hour and 10 minutes or 12 minutes from the time the eclipse began till there was totality. And frankly, for the first 50 minutes of that hour, it was just a normal day. We were sitting up and we had carried hiking chairs way up into the mountains, and we're sitting up on a high hill with being able to look in 365 degrees and down the river valleys. And there was no change. For the first 50 minutes, it was sort of like, well, we had our glasses on from time to time, and we could look up and see the sun being obscured as the moon moved from right to left across the sun, but the landscape didn't look any differently. There was plenty of light, and then at about 10 minutes before the eclipse reached totality, so I would say when the sun was about 80% obscured, for the first time, you felt things kind of getting weird. First thing that happened was birds stopped singing. Then, over a period of a few minutes, I became aware that it was getting a lot colder. And not only was it getting colder, it was getting windier. And the temperature started to plummet. And we had been in shirt sleeves, and it was warm, and everyone put on light parkas or sweaters as the temperature really went down. I don't know how many degrees it went down, but it was substantial over a period of 10 to 12 minutes. And then we got this sort of glowing. It was sort of like it was turning towards dusk, but it was still pretty bright. But it had this, the sky had this eerie look. And looking up into the mountains, I guess would have been a clear blue sky. It was sort of just gray and growing darker, but it was not totally dark. I mean, you could have played baseball or golf or tennis or done anything, didn't need car headlights. And then about 3 to 4 minutes before the total eclipse, this eeriness of this sort of feeling that things were different really took hold. But still, there was plenty of daylight. And what struck me as the eclipse totality approached is how little sunlight is needed to really light up the sky. And that only as we approached and then actually entered the totality of the eclipse did everything go dark. And it didn't go dark as night. You could take a picture with a camera without having the on your iPhone or a regular camera without needing the flash, but it grew really, really dark, but not black dark like it does at night. And we had the black glasses on, and I put my glasses up and looked at about 15 seconds before totality, and you could just see the very left edge of what appeared to be the sun as the moon moved. And then all of a sudden, with my glasses on, total dark. So So the eclipse glasses, which showed no light unless you were looking at the sun, went totally black. And I took off the glasses and I looked at the surroundings around me. And strangely enough, we were high in the mountains, but there were other groups scattered across this remote area. And you could hear the whooping of people yelling, screaming, you know, and sort of a whooping voice echoing through the tops of these ridges. And that in the near darkness was just kind of something that made sort of the hair go back up on the back of your neck. And you were standing there. In our case, we had about a minute and 40 seconds of totality. And during that time, I can tell you the wind really came up and the temperature just plummeted standing there. And it was this eerie feeling. You could see in the distance, but it was not dark. And then as quickly as the beginning of the totality occurred, it ended. And so for a minute and 40 seconds, you couldn't absorb everything. And as try as I might in retrospect, and I'm sure for those of you who saw the eclipse, you feel the exact same way. You wanted time just to be frozen. You wanted it to stop so you could take in everything. But we didn't have that chance. It went too quickly. And then just as that peak, this time of the right edge of the sun, with the totality ending, within seconds of that occurring, it was light again. And I mean really light. So what struck me is how much sunlight there is, even when the sun was 95-98% obscured, there's still a lot of light. And only when it goes into that totality do you lose that energy. And it struck all of us how dependent we are on the sun. Of course, it's the source of our life, that and water. But it struck us and me as we stood there and then reflected in it that the sun is everything. And even at 98% obscured, you still had plenty of light. So if you were looking at the eclipse in Chicago or St. Louis or somewhere else in the band where you had, 95% or 98% totality, you didn't get the full feeling of what it is to be in total darkness from the sun, but yet still have light on the ground. And the energy that takes place, and it's no wonder that the early the Mayans and the Native Americans and all the people who came before we understood how things worked with the sun and the moon thought this was the coming of the end of the world, and they worshipped gods. It was one of those oh my God moments. It was, can this really be happening? And yet then it was over so quickly. But what's not over is the impact of having stood high on that mountain with a group of close friends, seeing something that we'll never see again in our lives, at least not in this part of the world, and having it occur on a day when the sky was perfect. But it makes you realize also how vulnerable we are to events far beyond our control. Volcanoes of magnitude such as we've had in the past can alter the Earth's climate for years. And just one big eruption from one of the volcanoes in Yellowstone or along the Pacific coast will change the weather in America. What if we have an asteroid of some kind hit the Earth? It changes again the weather. So we talk about climate change and global warming and all these things happening as though we're in control. And standing high on that mountain last Monday morning, it struck me and all of us there, we're not in control. We're just a part. We're just a piece. We're standing here in a sliver of time in the history of the world, and we don't have any control over what nature's going to do. And the awesome power of the eclipse and seeing it happen makes you just realize that we're not even a meaningful player in what takes place in the world as far as the sun and the moon and the power of nature. And it was certainly a powerful, powerful moment to feel the temperature collapse, go down, the wind come up, enter near darkness, and then just seconds later have it be bright as light again. The other thing that happened was the anticipation of the building up to the eclipse in that hour and 10 minutes as the as the moon began to increasingly obscure the sun, everyone was looking at it periodically and saying and making comments. And after it passed, within 2 or 3 minutes, people were picking up their camping chairs and beginning the long hike down the mountain. It was just so imminent. We have as much time on the downside as we had on the upside. But the eclipse had happened, and it was over. So that's my story of watching the eclipse. And for those of you who saw it, I'm sure you have your own magnificent memories. It was indeed worth the effort to go see it. I'll be back in just a moment. And when I come back, I want to talk about a really, really bad idea that is suddenly being propagated by the state of Wyoming and apparently supported by the Department of Interior regarding the sage grouse and how they might be brought back from very low population levels. So thanks for listening. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN, and first a message from your Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio, and hope you enjoyed hearing about the eclipse and what I experienced. I'm going to move, though, from that once-in-a-lifetime event, if you will, although I guess we all know now in April of 2023, Carbondale, Illinois, will once again be the epicenter, so it's not often you get a mulligan. Southern Illinois is getting a mulligan, so all the traffic issues and things that occurred this past time, we can prepare for them with much better knowledge in 2023. But for the rest of the country, most of the areas that had the eclipse this time are nowhere near the eclipse next time. So Carbondale is actually, it just happens to be in the place where it's going to happen twice in 7 years, and that in and of itself is a quirk of nature. So shifting from Carbondale to Wyoming, and something that's going to affect all of us, is this continuing saga of the sage grouse, and are they going to be listed as an endangered species? Are they not going to be listed, and what can be done? And there's been a huge amount written and discussed about it. We've talked about this on the air from the very beginning because it would be the most impactful listing of a species in the history of America if we listed sage grouse on as endangered species, and there's a management plan under place by the western states to try to stop this from happening. And all of a sudden, the state of Wyoming decides it has a really bad idea. It wants to pen raise sage grouse in captivity as a quote-unquote conservation measure to help restock sage grouse into areas where their populations are declining or where there are not any. This is one of the absolutely stupid ideas that could come out of the conservation community. Actually, it's not coming out of the conservation community. It's coming out of a place that likes to be in the conservation community, and that's the legislature, which has no experience in this issue. And apparently, it's getting some support from the Interior Department in Washington that believes this is not necessarily a bad idea. But thanks to scientific research that goes back to the 1930s, some of which actually was led by the Max McGraw Wildlife Foundation outside of Chicago, we know a great deal about captive rearing birds, and in particular, we know about sage grouse. And it has been found that sage grouse absolutely do not do well when raised in captivity and then released. There are a number of papers that have been written about this, things that the sage grouse, there is no indication of any kind that sage grouse captive reared sage grouse put back into the wild have any kind of survival rates, have any kind of reproductive rates. And yet the state of Wyoming is trying to now decide that they're going to use this as a way to address the possible listing of sage grouse in endangered species. And so if one thinks for a moment about captive reared birds, bobwhite quail have been tried for 50 years to raise them in captivity and release them into the wild, a complete failure. In fact, that has actually entered where it's occurred. It's actually denuded. It's deleted the gene pool of wild quail and has compromised the integrity of the bird. Ringneck pheasants, we all know about ringneck pheasants. A lot of us do, being released, captive reared and released. If the habitat's not there, the pheasants die. There's just no way the captive reared birds will survive in habitat where wild birds themselves can't survive. They can be used to augment the population, help build populations, but they cannot be used, pheasants, if the habitat's not there. And in the case of sage grouse, this is a habitat issue strictly, and a lot of it has to do with weather, which is one of the things that the Environmental Protection Agency does not realize, is much of the decline in sage grouse that's occurring today has been occurring in areas where there has been extended drought. Sage grouse are a water-dependent bird. Although they're a desert bird, they're dependent on water. And when you've had extended droughts, mild winters, low snowfall, the sage grouse have not been able to reproduce in areas where habitat hasn't changed at all. The hand of man has not touched millions of acres of habitat that had sage grouse in it, which today either have none or low populations. The result of that is because we have not had the kind of climate that we need. We've not had the precipitation we need. So it's not a question of rearing birds and sticking them in the habitat. It's a question of Mother Nature has to provide more snowfall. So Wyoming is absolutely on the wrong side of this. In the 1960s and through it all the way to the 1980s, Idaho tried the same thing, stocking sage grouse. All of the sage grouse died, and they also found out that reproducing sage grouse, the second generation, almost all of them were infertile. 90% of the sage grouse in Idaho that were raised in captivity turned out to be unable to reproduce. So there is just no way that this is going to work. And yet the legislature in Wyoming, despite all the scientific evidence, is willing to throw money at this, and it just doesn't make sense. So as the writer who broke the story says, it appears Wyoming has laid an egg in this ill-advised legislation. The state would be wise to reconsider it immediately. In the meantime, we can only hope that the idea does not catch on with other states. And let's hope it also doesn't catch on with the Department of Interior. And just a couple minutes, which I have left, actually only about 30 seconds, I just want to comment, dove season is coming quickly. It'll be opening on Friday the 1st in Illinois and across America. And it looks like right now it could be a banner year in Illinois. So if you're making plans to go dove hunting, at least the beginning of the season right now in Illinois, it looks like it could be quite productive. I'll have more on that next Sunday morning after we've had the opening of the season. Thanks for joining me on the Great Outdoors Show. This is Charlie Potter and the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.